Calgary Show Services presents the Event Planning Podcast, featuring interviews with industry professionals to help you produce your next event.
On today's podcast, I joined Mark Hopkins at the Bustling Vendome to discuss his We Should Know Each Other events, licensing, theater production, Mexican wrestling burlesque shows, press releases, hiring a promoter, and haircuts by children. You can visit the event Haircuts by Children this coming Saturday, January 30th, 2016. It's put on by Swallow Bicycle Theater, Mammalian Diving Reflex, One Yellow Rabbit, and the High Performance Rodeo. Just Google Haircuts by Children HPR. We'll take you there. Today's event planning tip is in regards to sponsorship at your event. Our suggestion is to find out what is mutually beneficial between your event and your potential sponsors. For example, if your event attendee demographic is likely middle-aged women, perhaps you should approach a sponsor whose products appeal to that demographic. This will make it easier for the potential sponsor to make a positive decision to support your event. And now, our interview with Mark Hopkins.
If you don't mind to tell me who you are, what you've been up to in relation to events.
Sure. My name is Mark Hopkins. I guess my main event producing role is as co-artistic director of Swallow a Bicycle Theater, where we create original theater and put it up. But I do all sorts of other events. I founded the We Should Know Each Other event series, which is a Well, frankly, I just try to get people who wouldn't normally meet each other to get into a room together and meet each other. And I do all sorts of odd contracts. Like, I work with the Calgary International Film Festival doing pop-up performances. Work with the Calgary Peace Prize, putting up these sort of award events. And, basically I hop around, do all sorts of event things.
And for We Should Know Each Other, how did you promote it?
We Should Know Each Other is an interesting event in that it looks kind of just like a, you know, a house party or any kind of gathering. But what we're really trying to do is find people who are not usual suspects to each other, whatever that means. So we're trying to get people who are from very different demographics, whether that's ethnocultural, age, career path, income, whatever. We're trying to get those folks into a room together and hopefully give them some opportunity to interact in a way that is a little bit more than superficial kind of thing. So to your question, how do we get those folks? Well, it's hard because we've designed the way we interact with people to best allow us to hang out with the people we like the most. And often we like people the most when they're somewhat like us. If I look at my friend group, it's a lot of folks who work in the arts, it's a lot of folks who are white, it's a lot of folks who are about my age, etc. And so to convince people to like break that pattern and come into this space where you're going to be with people that may make you kind of uncomfortable is hard. To promote it, we do all sorts of different things. When I first started hosting the events, I basically just said, you're welcome to come alone, but I encourage you to bring somebody that has never been to one of these events before or somebody that you want to know better. And the idea with that, I ran the events every 2 weeks for 8 years, and so there was, you know, there was opportunity to grow. So it didn't matter if necessarily in that first event if it was the most diverse room, but the hope was that at the 50th event, because of that strategy, it would start to diversify itself kind of naturally. And then as the initiative grew, I started doing more and more partnerships. So for the 100th event, we rented out this giant abandoned school building in the Southwest and filled it. I ended up having about 82 partner organizations, basically just filling every classroom, hallway, gymnasium, boiler room with interesting activities. And the hope there was that each of those organizations, which themselves were really diverse, would interact with people in different ways and draw different crowds.
So how did you get people to engage once they showed up, like when it was in the initial stages in your apartment or whatnot?
Tried to be really casual and like understanding that what I'm asking people to do is really uncomfortable. I tried to make everything else as comfortable as possible. So that was part of the thinking behind hosting in my apartment initially was I've got a nice living room. It's comfortable. You know, you can come in and I will welcome you personally. And You'll get some chips, and if you want a beer, you can have a beer kind of thing. Trying to make that really welcoming and comfortable. But then I would be facilitating sort of very quietly, like if, say, a group of three people showed up together and they end up together in the kitchen, I would try to find ways to split them up. So that might be, I might literally go up to them and be like, hey guys, it's great that you came together, but this is a we should know each other. Why don't you go meet those people? And might be just like blunt force in that way. Or I might have had a conversation with somebody over in the corner that maybe connects with something that someone in the kitchen is saying, and I'll say, oh my God, have you talked to so-and-so? And then also just trying to make sure that everyone's getting what they need to take that step of talk to a stranger, whether it's, you know, talking to me first because I'm like a friendly face and then graduating to, or maybe they're willing to just jump in and I can just leave them alone and do their thing.
And did you ever have an agenda for the group, like a discussion that you would bring up to everyone, or it was just free form all the time, free for all?
We very occasionally would have directed we should know each other, but we tried not to. And part of the reason for that is if you look at the events that are already available, a lot of them are topic-based. You can go to a political speech, or you can go to an environmental talk, or you can go to a concert or whatever, and it's really all about the thing that is being either talked about or told to you. And with We Should Know Each Other, there is an agenda, and the agenda is
to get to know each other.
To get to know each other. And to get to know each other in very specific ways, to bridge across difference in some way. So we figured by removing that sort of, on the occasion that we did say, today we are going to talk about politics, it would attract people who give a shit about politics. And, you know, yes, there's some
diversity.
There
wouldn't be enough diversity for the event.
Exactly, yeah.
And so when you had that school function, or when you filled the school and you partnered with these other organizations, how did you coordinate that many different organizations? Like, how far in advance did you have to plan to make that event happen?
That event took, I think, about 6 months of planning. Yeah, give or take 6 months. And it started with, I knew I wanted to do a big, like, I was numbering the We Should Know Each Other events, and it got to 100, and I was like, holy crap, that's really exciting. So I knew I wanted to do something big and celebratory. So first I started by looking for a venue, because that determines a lot of what you're able to do. So we ended up being very lucky in this, the King Edward School, that C-Space is turning into a multi-use art space in 2016, 17, something like that. Back in 12, 13, it was just sitting empty, and they were really excited to launch this new initiative. So for them, it was a win-win where I would get my venue and they would get the attention of all these hundreds of people coming through it. And then it just started snowballing from there, where we, working with them, decided to do it on the weekend of Alberta Culture Days and the weekend of Doors Open YYC, which are two big, like, province-wise, city-wide initiatives. And then between, like, you know, C-Space, Doors Open, Alberta Culture Days, and We Should Know Each Other, which by then was fairly well-known and had a pretty good reputation, I just did a call out to, as broadly as possible, to say, I want organizations to be part of this. But I was pretty specific in how, like, I told them they can't just have a trade booth. It can't just be you.
It has to be something interactive.
Yeah. Like, yes, we want the people coming to meet you and your organization. That is important. But we also want them meeting each other. And so whatever you're doing can't just be you giving information about what you're doing. It has to somehow engage people in a way that they'll meet you, you'll meet them, they'll meet each other kind of thing.
So did you come across any licensing problems or fire regulation problems in the process of booking the venue or whatnot?
Yes. licensing is... When I started doing events, I didn't know anything about... bylaws, fire regulations, liquor licensing, you know.
And how did you learn about it?
I learned about them by trial.
The hard way.
Yeah, absolutely. By failing, really. By, we had a there's so many examples. I discovered very early in my theater career, we do site-specific theater, where we take plays into not theaters. And that seems like cool, and it is cool, but when you put a play in a theater, that theater is zoned for that specific activity. Like, you are very much allowed to do that there. And what I discovered early on is that you're not allowed to do that in a lot of places because of the zoning in Calgary. And so, in fact, quite accidentally, we were breaking the law by doing a show in a warehouse or whatever.
So how would people find out about the zoning laws and whatnot? Like,
how do people find out about it?
How would you suggest for somebody to find out?
311 is a good start, but it's not the end. So 311 is like the Calgary Information line, and it's a good start just in the sense that you can ask, like, who deals with zoning? What are bylaws? That sort of thing. The challenge with 311 is that these are, by definition, generalists. They have to know a lot about a lot of things. And so if you have a very specific question like I do about, how do I do a play in a warehouse in the Southeast, they are not going to know the answer. And in fact, they're going to struggle to be able to direct me to the person that I need to go to. So I found it very helpful to know who I'm talking to. Like, I'm talking to a 311 operator. What questions am I asking? I'm trying to figure out. I have a sense that this warehouse I'm working in might not be safe, and so I'm asking that person, how would I know if a building is safe? They might direct me to the fire department or to, like, I don't know, city engineers or whatever. But then there's also other resources, like if I'm doing an arts event, Calgary Arts Development has a art spaces consultant, Joni, whatever her last name is, Joni Carroll. And so she's great because you can call, instead of calling the city, you can call her, and she already has the relationships and knows what questions to ask. So being clear about what you're trying to do and then trying to figure out, like, who is the best person equipped to answer this question and how do I find them?
What about working with alcohol and alcohol vendors?
Alcohol is such a tricky beast because I understand why there's so much regulation. Like, we want people to be safe with alcohol, but the AGLC can be very challenging to work with. And the AGLC being the Alberta Gaming and Liquor Commission. If you're not, you know, bars have already gone through all this. Places that can serve liquor are great partners because, you know, they're dealing with it, and then you don't need to worry about it, and you can just show up and do your thing, and they'll tell you if you're breaking a rule, and you'll stop breaking the rule. The problem is if you're doing a pop-up in some other location and you want to serve booze, there's only very specific ways you can do that. A good start to figure that out is to call the AGLC and just be honest about what you're trying to do, because I think event producers have a tendency to try to figure out, I certainly have this tendency to be like, damn it, this is going to happen no matter what, and it's going to happen this way. But in fact, the way I want it to happen might be breaking a law. And then you got to figure out, are you okay with breaking a law? And am I okay with the consequences? Because there's a really good chance that someone will find out and you might not be able to do events anymore or not in that way. You know.
After We Should Know Each Other, when you had an opportunity to speak at TEDx, what was it like being involved in that event, like seeing how it was produced kind of from the back end and comparing it to some of the other things that you might have planned before?
Something that's wild is I've worked very small events in my living room and huge events, like, you know, Snowblower at Olympic Plaza and Lucha Vavoom at the Stampede Grounds. That was a Mexican wrestling burlesque show.
Of course.
And they're very different, of course, but there's some core capacities that you need for small living room event or giant stadium event kind of thing. And it's really just a matter of scale. Like, in both events, you want everybody coming to be able to hear and see what's important. In my living room, that's super easy. I don't need to, like, everyone can kind of hear each other and see each other. When you're in a giant theater or a stadium, it's actually kind of hard for people to hear and see. And so you got to figure out, like, what do I need in order for that to happen? And in those cases, you need, like, a whole team of technicians and stage managers and producers and that kind of thing, which if you've only done small events and you suddenly graduate to a big one, like, I've certainly screwed that up where I'm like...
But what did it feel like as being the talent instead of the planner? Did you learn something about the way that the event could be produced or something that you could do in the future that the TEDx planners showed you accidentally.
Being the talent is, you can definitely tell when it's a well-produced event or not when you're the talent. Because I've been in both situations, and in some, you know it's good when you just feel well taken care of. And when the questions you're asking, someone has thought of them before you ask them. That information sheet you get at the beginning or the phone call you had has already answered the question that you think of, like, the day before the show. And that, yeah, if you're a dancer, they already have the sprung floor that you need so you don't injure yourself. Or if you're a musician, they already have the back line, the PA, that's going to allow you to do that. And then, yeah, it gets, like, as talent, what you don't want to be is stressed out before you're giving a TED Talk, for example. Which, in my TED experiences, fortunately, they took really good care of me. They cared about me being able to get up there and do what I was there to do, which is give a talk. I shouldn't have to worry about the microphone. I shouldn't have to worry about the catering, how the audience is getting there. And in some events, you do end up worrying about those things because, you know, your mom is showing up to see you give a TED Talk. She's texting you backstage because they don't have her ticket and, you know, she can't find parking and whatever. And so that stuff ends up trickling up to the talent if it's not well taken care of.
When you're planning an event, how do you keep everything organized so that all of those small details aren't lost, like the parking and the backline and, you know, dressing rooms, all these small things?
A good start is spreadsheets, honestly. And what I love about spreadsheets is once you've made one, you can sort of, and it's a good one, you can kind of transfer it to different events. So, like, yeah, having categories around front of house, stage, access.
Signage.
Yeah, signage is such a big one because you can have all these amazing things and no one knows where they are. So I usually try to start with that spreadsheet and then trying to figure out, like, you don't need everything for every event. So what do I need? What's specialized about this one? When you're doing a Mexican wrestling burlesque show, you need a wrestling ring, which has never come up in any other event that I've done. And then recognizing what you're able to do. Because I did one big event once where I was early in my event producing career. I had many bands playing, many DJs, two stages, and I didn't hire sound technicians. I figured, oh, the bands can take care of themselves. And so I ended up just, like, getting all the gear there on time, but then there was nobody to set it up, no one to sound check, no one to do any of that stuff, which turned into a nightmare. We got it figured out, but I've never done that again in my life.
You seem like a pretty prolific volunteer, and I'm wondering, what do you get out of volunteering, and how do you utilize volunteers at your events?
Volunteering was, when I was just starting out, like graduating university, that was the way I got every job I've ever had. I came out of university, didn't know what I was doing, didn't know what I wanted to do, and so I just started being like, who's already doing things that are cool? How can I help? And so I just started volunteering indiscriminately for anyone that I thought was doing anything remotely cool. And that ended up translating into all sorts of opportunities I couldn't have predicted. And now I volunteer more selectively. I volunteer for things that I think are making positive change in the world. And where I see myself being able to productively help. Event producing is a good example. There's a lot of people who are working in very important areas who don't know how to promote or produce an event. So if I can come in and volunteer my services that are worth something to help that group, I will. I, in my events, rely on volunteers. There's, you know, frankly, I've done a lot of events and most of them don't have enough money, and most of them were like, yeah, scotch taping it together in some way. And even if we weren't, like, having volunteers that, the thing about volunteers is they hopefully believe in what you're doing, because otherwise why would they be there? And to have a team of people that are on board to help the patron experience, help the talent, help you, is something that, like, A, is practically necessary, but also is, like, almost emotionally necessary to say, like, yeah, this is something worth doing, and we're going to help you do it.
And about the financing, have you ever worked with sponsors? Like, a larger company to sponsor the entire event, or maybe people to donate to a silent auction, something like that. How do you go about approaching the sponsors?
There's a whole industry around how to approach sponsors, but it's actually, frankly, not all that complicated. It's trying to figure out what is the mutual benefit between whatever you're doing and the sponsor that's helping you out. And a lot of the traditional ways that can be looked at is, oh, they get a tax receipt if they're working with me as a charity, or they get exposure if they're working with me as an event. But you can go a lot deeper than that. Like, I don't know, you're producing some concert, and let's say, well, Carol of the Bells. Kenna Barima just did that, Carol of the Bells, which is this awesome concert featuring, well, this year they paired it up, but like female musicians and sponsoring the Wise Guys program at Calgary Sexual Health Center. I have no idea how she approached her sponsorship or her funding, but the fact that that event is benefiting the Calgary Sexual Health Center is really awesome. That event becomes a sponsor, and it's mutually beneficial because Wise Guys needs funding and needs attention, and Carol of the Bells needs a... It's saying that it wants to make a change in society, that it wants to make the world better. How is it doing that? By supporting this worthwhile program. And so if you look at it in that lens, try to figure out, like, who else cares about this? Who else cares about women's rights? Who else cares about music? And, you know, off the top of my head, I would go to Village Brewery right away. They might give you some products. I would maybe...
They were sponsoring the event.
Were they? Yeah. There you go. I didn't know that. But yeah, like, look at who else has sponsored things in the past. And not just, like, who else usually sponsors, but why do they sponsor? And maybe some organization that you are aware of that's never even thought about sponsoring an event, but maybe the way they operate clearly shows you that they care about the same things you care about. You can go to them and say, I don't know what this looks like, but could you help us out?
So Swallow a Bicycle, how do you coordinate your time and just make sure you're there on opening day?
Something that's nice about event production generally in theater particularly is that, as you pointed out, you do have an opening night, and so it's got to get done. When you've got a public showing up and they're going to pay money to be there, you better damn well be finished. So I've done it in healthy ways and I've done it in unhealthy ways. Like, certainly starting out, when you're just barreling towards that opening night, that event date, when I was discovering, holy crap, I didn't know we needed to do this, you end up pulling all-nighters, and it's not super awesome. Really, it's been, for me, a trial-and-error process to figure out how much time does it actually take to do a rehearsal process, how much time does it take to write a play, to write a film? And you can absolutely, once you have a sense of how much time it's going to take, you can give yourself more or less time, but not to undercut that time. So right now, like, Swallow Bicycle will be running for, I think, almost 9 years, and we're just now getting into a process where we're actually giving ourselves 2 years to create a new play. We, in the past, have, like, done 3 plays a year, and just been really productive, and that's been great for a lot of reasons, but it risked burning us out, it risked burning out our artists, and frankly, it wasn't giving us the best possible result. So now what we're experimenting with is trying to figure out, like, what happens if we actually raise a whole bunch of money for this thing? What happens if we actually give ourselves time to think about the topic we're trying to communicate? And maybe even change direction. Like, maybe we thought the play was going to look like X. Maybe in order to get its point across, it needs to look like Y. Which, when you're barreling towards an event, whether it's a concert or a talking event or whatever, you often don't have time to rejig it once you discover, oh, maybe this isn't the best way. So that's not, like, a clear answer, but I think it's getting a sense of how much time this thing could take. And then there's realities that exist. Like, if you need to deliver it by a certain time, what is possible to sacrifice?
And when you have put all that time and you do have the production that you know people are going to want to see, how do you get people in the seats? Okay.
Again, there's, like, a whole industry around that. But when I was starting out, like, the very first event I ran, I didn't know how to exactly that question. Like, we have this cool event. How do we get people there? And I looked around, and I'm like, hey, there are magazines. And other people get their events in magazines. How would I get my event in a magazine? So I just pulled, like, at the time, RIP Fast Forward, but there was Fast Forward, Swerve, whatever, and I just looked up, literally opened up, like, the front cover of those magazines and found an email address for somebody that seemed like they would care about what I was doing and emailed them. Didn't know how to write a press release, didn't know how to do any of that stuff, but it worked. And then it's really easy to either download a media release template from the internet or find someone who has had a cool event and buy them a coffee and say, how did you write a media release? And it's not just writing a good media release, it's actually sending it to the people who care. And media attention is helpful, but it's really funny how sometimes it translates to huge crowds and sometimes it doesn't. So it's really a matter of, like, figuring out all the different ways that you can get eyeballs on what you're doing. And that might be Facebook, Twitter. It might be posters. It might be word of mouth. It might be traditional media attention. So it really matters who you're trying to get into the room and what they look at.
Is there a demographic that you've kind of pinpointed that are most likely to attend a Swallow a Bicycle performance? And then how do you promote specifically to that demographic?
Oh, that's such a great question. I'm such a nerd. So we've actually, like, you know, we have the luxury of being this 8-9-year-old theater company. And so we've actually been surveying our audiences for the past 4 years to figure out who they are. And we know that our audiences tend to be between, like, 25 to 45 years old, but we've actually got a decent bump of, like, 60 to 75 year olds, slightly more women than men, etc. And as we do surveying, we actually can get better at surveying to figure out, because, you know,
more specific information.
Well, and what information is going to be helpful? Because if I know that my audiences are, like, 20 to 35, I can make some assumptions around that, but what if these are the 20 to 35-year-olds that aren't on Facebook? So I might stereotypically think that oh, they're young people, they're on Facebook, but then you also ask the question about how did you hear about this? And they might tell you they heard about it through, I don't know, some
Swerve
random...
or something.
Yeah, or even like they might write something in that you never thought of. And then we try to get more and more detailed in terms of what questions we're asking so that then we can look at that information when we're doing a new project and say, oh, these are the folks that have usually come to Swallow Bicycle shows. Are those the same people that need to come see this show? If so, let's talk to them. If not, how do we attract people that are not already coming?
And have you ever hired a promoter to promote not just Swallow Bicycle, but any event?
Absolutely.
What is the process like?
The thing that I always have to struggle with is, like, when I'm working on a cash-strapped show, I always want to pay the artists. That's my main priority, or whoever it is. I want to pay the people that are doing the thing that we're coming together for. And so I have to always make choices in terms of, I could hire amazing graphic designers, web designers. I could hire PR specialists, media consultants, marketers, that sort of thing. But every time I'm putting money into their hands, I need to make sure I'm not sacrificing the money that's coming from the people that are actually doing the work for the show. Not that this other work isn't important.
That's tricky because the other ones are possibly contributing to the pool.
Totally.
So how do you find the balance between that budget? Like, is this amount going into the initial investment going to be returned to contribute to the artist kitty or not? Like,
and you're absolutely right. Like, if you don't hire the person, you might not get the audiences coming in, and you might not be able to pay your artist. So it's a bit of a circular thing. For me, it was like, you know, we just make a budget, honestly. Like, we figure out how much money would it take to pay our core people what they need to get paid. Do we have that much money? No. How are we going to make it? And if we do have that much money, how much more money do we have to pay other people, which might allow us to pay our people more, sort of thing. And so, yeah, I've had the really great fortune of working with people who are media relations specialists. They're really good. Like, they have spent years often developing relationships with editors, with media professionals, and so they have access in ways that I do not have. And so And it's just such a relief to know that, like, it's that's taken care of.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can spend more time producing the event.
Yeah, the thing that you're doing.
The show that you want people to see.
The problem sometimes is that because of the mentality I just described, where we don't have money, we'll end up... You'll look at these sort of media consulting groups, or event production groups for that matter, and you'll look at the price tag and be like, oh God, we can't afford that. And so you'll find someone who will do it for less money and assume that you still have that sense of relief that they'll just take care of it. And that's often not the case. Like, if you're working with a young publicist or a young event producer, not even just young, but like that's not established in whatever they're doing, you still have to do a lot of hands-on work with them. And it's not, whenever you're hiring anyone, it's not like you can just sort of say, okay, go. You still have to be involved in it, but sometimes that extra money is worth it if you know that they know their shit and they're going to ask you only the questions that they need to ask, and you can just sort of go back to what you're doing.
We get a lot of that on our end as event technician, like to do the production itself. If people don't have the budget, say for lighting or additional staff or whatnot, then we'll bring less equipment or might not have enough people available to give the proper attention that the artist might need, or somebody's running back and forth from the stage simply because we couldn't afford to have another person there.
Yeah.
And then, so I think, like, if it is possible to have just an amazing looking poster, that's going to put more people into the seats, and just all these little details that cost money. And that's why it's so important to get the sponsors in line. And like,
yeah,
that's really the purpose of this podcasting, is to just enlighten people onto how to do that in a way where the event quality is just increasing over time, mm-hmm. so that the experience of the patrons is...
Totally. Well, I think you hit on something there, that over time piece, because, like, realistically, as an event producer, I can't afford at every event to hire who I want to hire. I can't afford to get the best graphic design, the best web design, the best sound technicians, the best event producer, but I can afford to get a couple of those. And I have to figure out, like, this event that I'm doing coming up, what is it trying to accomplish, and how does it fit into the bigger picture? Like, as you pointed out, if I want my audience to have a great time at my event and then come back the next time, I got to give them a great event. And so maybe I should be, if I know I'm doing a series of events, figure out what I care about most. Do I care about having a big crowd that's going to just like have fun by virtue of having a huge group of people there? Then let's promote the hell out of this thing. Maybe I don't care about that. Maybe I actually really want...
more engagement. Or,
yeah, like 30, 40 people that really want to be there, and I want to give them an amazing experience. So then I'm going to really work on the event production value. And yeah, I think that why question, like, why am I doing this? Because every event, like, I always want every event to be, like, the best event. And sometimes I feel like that means it needs to be the best promoted, best produced, best... and it doesn't. If to be the best event of what it's trying to accomplish, it might need to be one of those things or two of those things, but not all of those things.
So what are you working on currently aside from the Swallow a Bicycle production?
Well, right now the exciting project I have is the end of January, called Haircuts by Children. It's part of the High Performance Rodeo. We're bringing in a group from Toronto called Mammalian Diving Reflex. I work with companies with weird names. And it's a show where literally we're going to have 10-year-olds cutting adults' hair. So it's amazing. Like, in terms of event producing, it's actually amazing the lessons I'm learning in this production, like working with the Calgary Board of Education, getting vulnerable population police checks, and figuring out, like, school buses and all this stuff that I would never have to think about when I'm doing events for adults.
From wrestling ring to school buses.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a huge learning experience, but again, like, all the principles stay the same. So doing that, hopefully We Should Know Each Other's been on hiatus for the past few months, and we're looking to relaunch that in February, March. And the Calgary Peace Prize is coming up in April, which we haven't announced the recipient yet, but it's going to be very exciting.
And if you were stranded on a desert island and could only eat one meal for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Holy crap. Well, I'm vegetarian, so that narrows it down. I had this really good... This is going to sound so hipstery, but I was in Montreal recently. I had this amazing raw vegan lasagna with, like, this kale salad next to it. And, my God, I hate myself for just saying that. But it was really good. So some combination of those ingredients would be great.
And lastly, where can people find out about you and Swallow a Bicycle and all the things that you're doing?
I'm all over the web. So Swallow a Bicycle Theater has website, Facebook, Twitter, that whole business. We Should Know Each Other also has all of those resources. And otherwise, just Google me, Mark Hopkins, Calgary. There's also a Mark Hopkins Hotel in San Francisco. That's not me.
If you should see if you can stay there and be like a patron saint of the hotel just for a night, you know?
I am so tempted, but I also think, like, my name is so common, they probably get that all the time.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me on the podcast. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening. This podcast was produced by Duncan Kenworthy, Eric Jesse, and Chris Benoit. Visit us online at calgaryshowservices.com to join our monthly newsletter for inventory updates and event insights.